welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagmann Report. It's Tuesday. Can you believe this? It's October 1st, 2024. What happened to summer? I'm still waiting for Labor Day, Memorial Day, actually. But that's long gone. But here we are. 36 days, 35 days from the 2024 election. A lot of stuff, I'll tell you what, in the next 30 plus days, a lot of things can and I'm sure will be happening. Pay very close attention. I joined Brandon House last night on Worldview Weekend TV. If you didn't get a chance, you can certainly, I think, go in the archives to grab to see that appearance. We had a good conversation. And I've got a very special show for you today. Let me tell you something. With everything that's happening, everything that's going on, especially with the recent assassination attempts, you know, people are looking at how assassinations could very well and have changed politics, the political landscape. And it's interesting because we have a very special guest with us. We do. As a matter of fact, have you heard the name James Files? Have you heard the name James Sutton, Jimmy Sutton, James Sutton? Have you heard of the book Primary Target, How the CIA Used the Chicago Mob to Kill the President? This is in reference to JFK. Have you heard about this book? I have my own special copy, and it's really a great copy. I want to show you the inside. You can see that little black, I know it's hard to see, but there's a little black mark there on the page, and that is the fingerprint, actually the, I believe the thumbprint of James Files. And you might say, well, who is James Files? James Files is, states that he was the man on the grassy knoll that took the shot that, hit President Kennedy in the right side of his head and blew the back of his head off. Now he's a born again Christian. He is in the same area, next room, with Pamela Files, who is going to be introducing him and speaking on his behalf. When I say introducing him, telling us about who he is and his story, because this book, Primary Target, was written by Pamela Files and James Files. And, you know, of all the JFK books I've read, and I've read a lot, from Roger Stone's to Jerome Corsi. And by the way, speaking of Jerome Corsi, his book, this book makes some references to the brain injury of JFK. And Jerome Corsi's book verifies information in this book. And I don't think that was planned. I can tell you it wasn't planned. So I want to play you, just before I bring her on, I want to play you just an introduction. I'll read the introduction here. But this introduction, it's a rolling text introduction. Watch it, read it with me. But this was in a documentary about James Files. And I think that it's important for everyone to understand exactly who this man is and what role he played in American history. So let's go ahead and roll that text. All right. In 1989, Houston private investigator Joe West launched an independent investigation to find the true assassins of President John F. Kennedy. After 3 years of disappointments and dead ends, After 3 years of disappointments and dead ends, West received a tip from an unexpected source, an FBI agent who asked to remain nameless. The tip led Joe West to Stateville Correctional Center at Joliet, Illinois, and a prisoner named James E. Files. Now, Files, who was serving time for attempted murder of an Illinois police officer, was at first very reluctant to talk. Slowly and meticulously, West established a relationship with Files. Through months of personal visits and detailed correspondence, files began to reveal his participation in the JFK assassination. Files was nearing a full confession when West became ill and suddenly passed away in 1993. Opining now, funny how that happens. It took 13 months after Joe West's death. But on March 22nd, 1994, associates of West videotaped an interview with Files. It was during this interview that James Files first confessed to being the shooter on the grassy knoll in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963, that it was he who delivered the final fatal shot to JFK's right temple. He also implicated organized crime members Charles Nicoletti, Johnny Roselli, Sam Giancana, all who had been murdered in the 1970s. Again, funny how that happens, but I digress. For the next two frustrating years, attempts were made to bring the interview to the public. This finally led to an agreement for a nationwide TV program. As the program was being prepared, a consultant became involved. Now, based on his input, the program was suddenly canceled for reasons that have since been proven to be untrue. Again, funny how that happens. Also, reputable JFK researchers have confirmed that the consultant was solidly connected to the Central Intelligence Agency. Upon his retirement in 1998, the FBI agent who had given the original tip on James Files decided to come forward. His name is Zach Shelton. Now, Mr. Shelton, who worked organized crime for 28 years, had an impeccable service record with the financial support of Dutch businessman Wim Dankbar. Shelton offered to proceed with a new investigation to either prove or disprove the confession of Mr. Files. Now, Shelton called upon and received the assistance of over 10 of his veteran FBI colleagues. All of those men have equally impressive careers with the Bureau. While the FBI has officially declared James Files to be, quote, not credible, end quote, the findings of Shelton and his colleagues have shown otherwise. Again, funny how that happens. After painstaking efforts to persuade Files, who had vowed to never again be interviewed, he ultimately agreed to another interview. The second and last interview was taped on November 19th, 2003. All right, you can cut it right there. And if you can jump to the time marker I put in that, and when you're ready, let's roll this. Because Mr. Files, okay, who's ill, obviously. He is not going to appear on camera. And folks, please pray for this man. Pray for his soul. Pray for this man. All right. Regardless of his past deeds, there is forgiveness by our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and understand that people can be forgiven. The point of this broadcast, of course, is to bring out all sides, all information, accessible, available information about that day in 1963, and even how it relates to current events. But with respect to 1963, James Sutton, James Files, there's something here. So, but you may know him if you see him. And again, out of deference and respect for Mr. Files, who is ill, I'm going to just roll like a brief clip of Mr. Files so you can get the feel for him. You can look at him and understand who we're talking about, who is right in the next room. And again, in need of your prayers for restoration of his health and obviously for his walk with our Lord and Savior. So let's go ahead, if you're ready. Let's just give the audience a taste of who Mr. Files is and the front portion of that interview. Here it is.
When Joe West first originally contacted me here at Stateville Prison, I was on a visit. The counselor came in the visiting room where I was at and stated that she wanted me to come out and make a phone call. I told her, I said, no way. I'm here 365 days a year. I'm not leaving my visit to go make a phone call. I said, who's calling? She told me, someone from Texas named Joe West. I told him, I do not know the party. I said, tell them I'll call them on my time, not their time. I'm on a visit. Don't bother me when I'm on a visit. The next day, they come, got me out of my cell. They took me downstairs and got a phone call hooked up. I called Joe West to talk to him. I told him, you have 3 minutes to convince me why I should talk to you. As Joe started talking to me, I told him, I said, whoa, stop. I said, you're on a lot of touchy spots. I said, these phone calls are recorded. Every phone call going in and coming out is recorded. If you want to talk to me that bad, then I suggest you come and visit me. Joe West had me put him on his visiting list. He come up to visit me. He spent 2 days up here talking with me. The first day, I wouldn't even talk to him about the Kennedy situation. We got into sports, weather, generally about prison, local things, till I got comfortable with him. The next day, after I thought it over all night, Joe S. seemed like a pretty nice guy. I really liked Joe. He had a magnetism about him. The next day, we sat down, we got serious, and then we started talking. I sit in the dining or in the visiting room with Joe. They gave us a pencil and paper. I sketched the entire Lilly Plaza out for him without any maps, without any pictures, nothing present. And I explained to Joe at that time, because Joe wanted to know where was I at. And I said, I'm going to put an X on the paper to signify me, but this X is not in the correct spot. I said, when the time comes, then I will put the X where it is supposed to be.
What had he told
you? Okay, you can cut that right now. Yeah, just so people understand, again, who we're talking about, talking with through Pamela Raphaels, his wife. He has since married, and Pamela Raphaels is my guest. One more thing before I bring her on. And again, this is right out of this book, which you can grab a copy of this book, and we're going to tell you how to get it. And I suggest you do, because to me, this reads like part investigative report, part almost like a journal, part conversation, but it's an extremely, extremely informative book, the book titled Primary Target. And I do suggest everyone grab a copy of this, especially in light of today. But I want to read one thing, and this is from page 371. This grabbed me, especially with our work with the late Russ Dizdar, his team Shatter Ops, Save Them, and so on. I just want to read this. James Files. Hello, I'm Jimmy Sutton. This is James Files talking now. But before I was Jimmy Sutton, I was just an X number. Later, I became Jimmy Sutton. Then in late 1963, I became James Files. I am a product of the U.S. government. Boy, I hope he forgives me for reading this, okay? And my mother, Vera Lawler Files Sutton Brassel, in quotation marks, was part of a Navy birthing program where they were trying to create a perfect Aryan soldier. Back in the 1930s and 1940s, the Nazis weren't the only ones trying to develop a breed of super soldiers. The U.S. had their own program, and that's how I was born. I really didn't want to mention it, but Pamela insisted. So, just saying. I didn't go to regular schools. Was sent to Camp Hero at Montauk on Long Island, New York, and for my extensive military training and education. And I'm not going to go on, but that gives you a taste of who James Sutton is. Now let's talk with Pamela Files, Pamela Raphaels, his wife. Pamela, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Was that okay? Did I do okay on that?
We did great. That was a good overview, so people can kind of understand it if they're not familiar with this story.
Yeah, you know, it's like, okay, with everything going on, you're talking about this. Well, I think this is important because, it's one of the hinge moments in time, an inflection point in our history. We've been lied to, and you are the wife of the man who says he fired the final and fatal shot that killed President John F. Kennedy. So where do you want to start? Knowing, of course, James Files is there with you, and I do. Let me ask you this first: how is he doing? How's he feeling? Is he on the mend, or
he was on the mend when he was getting physical therapy here at home, but then when that stopped, the progress kind of stopped, and the physical therapist at the hospital that's in a town close to us said that he shouldn't have been taken off that physical therapy yet, and he's doing his exercise and whatnot, but he doesn't have the use of his left side as like he used to. And so but as far as his lungs and his COPD and all those issues that he was having, that's gotten a lot better. So, you know, when you can't breathe, that's not good. So yeah, he's gotten a lot better in that department, but as far as just being physically down still, it's, you know, something he needs prayer for.
Yes. And folks, I ask everyone in the audience, please keep James Files in your prayers, both for his physical recovery as well as his walk with our Lord. Okay, Pamela, where do you want to start? I mean, where do you want to start?
It's kind of up to you, because I can go any direction that you want. I can start with the book. I can start with current events. I can start wherever you want to start. But what do you think your audience is most interested in?
Well, let's start with the book itself, because the book goes into a lot of detail about the days leading up to November 22nd, 1963, James Files, mm-hmm. his involvement in this, and how he came to be involved. Right. Let's lay the groundwork for that day in Dallas of 1963. How did James Files become that person behind or on the grassy knoll, behind the stockade fence where Eric and I were there? We've been to Dealey Plaza, and we've seen that. That's not a very big area. So, but let's lay the groundwork as to how James Files came to be behind that fence in Dealey Plaza.
Well, he was asked to be a weapons bearer to Dallas by Charles Nicoletti at this place called the Harlow Grill. There's the Harlow Grill. Charles Nicoletti and James Files frequented there. And one day when he was there playing pinball, Charles Nicoletti came in, said, "I need to talk to you. Let's go." And he says, "You know, wait, I've got to finish the game." He's like, "No, now." And so that's when Charles Nicoletti approached him in early 1963 to talk about doing a job. That's how they referred to, you know, assassinations, just doing a job. And so Charles Nicoletti approached him, but they were going to maybe first do it in Chicago, but then Tony Accardo, who was the main Godfather guy, he said, "No, not in our backyard." So eventually they were told, "Just wait, and then we'll tell you when it's going to happen." And so when Charles Nicoletti came in that one time, he said, we're going to do it down in Dallas, and I need you to drive the weapons down there. So that's pretty much how it started for him as far as the actual assassination in November of 1963. But his life, like you just read and you were referring to, started with the military when he was born, and then going to Camp Hero when he was an 8-year-old kid learning how to kill. And so he was recruited into the CIA out of the Army. I guess I'm getting ahead of myself a little, but he lived his whole life in Melrose Park in Illinois, pretty much his whole childhood growing up. And he was around the Italians and the people that were doing organized crime in the Chicago area. But he would get sent off on the Greyhound bus by his mom to Camp Hero and go spend, you know, a few months over there and then come back. And then when he would come back, he wouldn't go to regular schools. He would just hang out and, you know, just do stuff at the house or go out and run around and do stuff, but he wouldn't have to go to school like the all the other kids. So he's been trained for a long time to be a person that would be able to do those kind of things without, you know, getting scared or flinching or, you know, not feeling like you might have the nerve to do it. He was bred for that. Okay. So it's just hard to pinpoint exactly. But then when he was in the military, something happened over in Laos. That's where he was shipped off to from Fort Bragg in 1959, July 10th. And he was over there on Operation Mobile White Star with Fletcher Pouty's group that was doing the work that they were laying the foundations for the Vietnam War. And something happened where he had to do something that he was asked to do, and it made the people in charge think that he might not be mentally stable, and they sent him to the Veterans Hospital in right by Chicago there, Edward Hines Veteran Hospital. And then when he was there being reviewed, that's when David Atlee Phillips came in with a folder that had an X number on it, and he recruited him into the CIA. And so he wasn't in the military that long.
If I can just add, because you mentioned some names here that obviously people who've studied the research of the JFK assassination, David Atlee Phillips was his CIA handler, right? That was him.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Every day.
Okay.
For his whole life, after being recruited into the CIA, when he wasn't in a federal or state prison, he had to check in with that man every day to see if he had an assignment. And if he didn't, he was free to go do what he needed to do for organized crime. But if he had a mission to go accomplish somewhere in the world, he was either given the file, or the file would be somewhere like at the Midway hangar, the CIA place that they would go meet and have their meetings. And he would just fly off and go take care of business. And that would be basically flying around the world, you know, to do assassinations at the CIA's bidding.
And he was, as stated initially, he was bred for that by the military, or by the CIA. Is that an accurate statement? I mean, he was born and raised for that.
During the time, it wouldn't have been a topic of conversation. It would have just been one of those unstated things that that's what was going on.
Okay.
A lot of times, I'm like, well, didn't you talk about this or that or the other thing? No, we didn't talk about that stuff. So I'm like, oh, okay. So he's talked more about what his life was really like, and I don't even know all the details at this point. But he's told me more than he's ever opened up about anything, because his whole life was compartmentalized and meant to be where you just don't tell your secrets. And the mob tells you to be like that. The CIA tells you to be like that. So you just live your life and you don't tell all those secrets. I mean, cough up a lot of secrets for this book. But he said at the very back, too, all his really dark secrets are going with him to the grave. So just in case anybody's watching, I don't know those dark secrets, and I don't want to know those really dark secrets, because what I do know is already bad enough. So, yeah, he's just going to have to, you know, stand before God and plead the blood of Jesus, hopefully, and not any of his own righteousness, because he's got a lot of explaining to do if he's going to be trying to just, you know, do it on his own. So that's what I'm trying to help him understand right now, because he's having a hard time struggling with that part of the faith. So that you have to be good. I'm like, dude, you have to be good because you got saved, not because it makes you saved. Anyway, long story. Just need a lot of prayer on that. But yeah, It's been a wild ride getting all this information out. And he said he's sorry that he told me so much, and he didn't want a lot of these things in the book, like the birthing program. He didn't want the part in there about Operation Group 40, you know, down in Mexico City with that picture on Barry and the Boys, where, you know, all those guys are sitting around the table. And I said, was that you? And he told me at first it wasn't him, but it was him. And so he basically was part of George Bush Sr.'s Operation Group 40, which is a worldwide assassination group. And that picture was taken on, I believe, January of 1963. He swears up and down that had nothing to do with the JFK assassination, but a lot of the players are still the same. So,
you know, that picture is in the book, folks. I put it in there. Right. And I really enjoyed reading the book. And folks, if you have any interest at all, and I suspect you would if you're watching this program, into current events with respect to, you know, political assassinations, what the government's done, or if you want to enrich yourself with additional knowledge about JFK, primary target. And all of the books by Pamela Ray with James Files, Pamela Files, of course, go to the website. You can see it on the lower third there. It'll be in the program description box at HagmanPI.com. And not just for your own self, but support as well. Support the Files family because, again, look, people can change. They are James Files is we need to pray for him. Go ahead. I mean, he's a changed man in my view, and changing, but we need to keep praying for him. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is the picture that's in the book.
Yes.
And the one that's sitting next, which way do I want to go?
Other way. Keep going. There you go. Keep going a little more, up a little bit. And there you go.
Oh, sorry, Terry.
There you go.
Okay, the guy with the coat over his face, that's Frank Sturgis, and then the guy sitting next to him, that's James Files. And I thought, you know, dude, you should have told me that a long time ago. But he just didn't want to reveal all those secrets. And I said, wait, that's important. And then now he tells freely, oh, yeah, Luis Posada Carrillas, this other guy, this anti-Castro Cuban guy, both he and I were the first ones that George Bush recruited into Operation Group 40. I'm like, oh, yep. Okay, I guess you're just telling it how it is now. But, yeah, he used to work for George Bush Sr., Henry Kissinger, you know. He was a hitman for all sorts of people, like
that would be what many Americans would classify like a shadow government, right? Working for that Operation 40? Is that right?
Yeah, most people don't even know that thing exists. But, you know, if you kind of study some of this, or if you get into that book by Daniel Hopsicker, wherever my Burying the Boys is, one of the chapter titles at the beginning is All Our Secrets Are the Same. They use these people throughout all the things that were going on, from the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy assassination, the other assassinations, on right into Watergate. Watergate was not what we were told either. There's Watergate 2. Some of that information's here in the book.
Yep.
And that explains how that, you know, they went in to get a film. Not, you know, it wasn't the cover story that, you know, history books tell us about. That film had, it was a training film at one of the camps they had there, Lake Pontchartrain in Louisiana. And it had several well-known people nowadays, but back then that would have been unknown. But it would have destroyed the political career of George Bush Sr. if he would be seen on a film of guys jumping out of a deuce and a half, holding their guns up, looking at the camera. David Atlee Phillips was there. George Bush was there. Lee Harvey Oz was there. I mean, all these people were there. And it's like that film was what got Barry Seal killed, because he had a copy of it in his trunk when the FBI came, when they got shot to death. And then it got disappeared again. But he was trying to blackmail George Bush Sr. with the fact that, you know, his political insurance was that, you know, he wasn't ever going to go down because he had that on George Bush. But little did he know that he was just going to switch history around and get him assassinated, get the evidence, and then there it goes. It's, you know, it's down the memory hole. So a lot of stuff happened, talking about
Barry Seal, right? I mean, that was
referencing. Yeah, Barry Seal.
Barry Seal. Okay. Okay.
He was what considered America's biggest drug smuggler or whatever, but he was a really good pilot. Jimmy always says he should have been born with wings on. He was used and lied to by the CIA. And so, when the DEA put some cameras in his plane, the Fat Lady, and then they got footage of things that they shouldn't have, and it's just a big long story. But Barry Seal thought that he was always going to be able to get out of it because he had the goods on George Bush Sr. But I guess that didn't, you know, shows you how much power George Bush
And
it
folks,
didn't happen that way.
And I have to say, your book, Primary Target, James' book, your book, co-authors, by the way, it offers so much more than just the event of November 22nd. It gives you the backstory, and it gives you some of the after story, a lot of the after story, to be honest, about the whole time period, and even extending into the Clinton era, the Bush era. And you can even drag it through today. Now, let's go back to James is in Chicago, and he gets a call he gets an order by David Atlee Phillips, if I'm understanding this correctly, to ask him to take weapons down to Dallas. Is that kind of how this started?
Well, James Files answered to David Atlee Phillips and to Sam Giancana, Antonio Cardo, and Charles Nicoletti.
Okay.
So I don't think the CIA had David Atlee Phillips talk to Charles Nicoletti. I think the CIA would have Sam Giancana talk to Charles Nicoletti to tell him to bring weapons to Dallas. But they both knew what was going to happen in Dallas. And Sam was in Dallas that day. David Atlee Phillips was around, too.
I'm jumping ahead. What got me about James, you're both writing about the area, Dealey Plaza. James stated it was like old homes week. All the people that he recognized from George Bush standing, I think, in front of this Texas School Book Depository. We've heard stories of that, and yes, that was true. And then all the other people in the vicinity that he recognized. It just blew my mind. It really did.
Right.
Wow.
It was compartmentalized, and he knew what he was access, what he had access to. But everybody that was there for their own reasons, he didn't go around and get a clipboard and say, oh, so why are you here? Just to watch? Oh, no, you're here to try and shoot too? Oh, okay. No, people in that business, they just ignore each other, act like they don't know each other. They go do their job and then they don't talk about it.
Right. And this is something, look, I've done my share of interviews at Attica with inmates there, Rikers. I've got to say this reads very true, especially with how inmates respond to people coming into their lives. And I just could relate very well with this book. Okay, so James was ordered to run weapons into Dallas, but wasn't told anything else. I mean, that's all. You take these weapons, you go to Dallas and wait for further orders. Is that right?
Well, Charles Nicoletti, when he initially told him that they were going to do, he said, we're going to do a friend of yours. And he thought, oh, what'd that guy do? I mean, he thought it was somebody else, but he's like, no, I'm talking about John F. Kennedy, the president. And Jim Files says, oh, okay, well, that's what we're supposed to do. That's what we're going to do. And at that time, his name was James Sutton or Jimmy Sutton. Everybody knew him as Jimmy Sutton. But after the assassination, he became James Files because he wanted to raise a family and have a different name than Sutton. I guess that was the main reason, but yeah. So, it was understood at first that they were going to do JFK, but then, and he even showed me, there's a place in the book I took a picture of him pointing, right here is where we were going to shoot him, onto the freeway, and then the car would have just gone by. But that was in Chicago, and Tony Accardo said, no way, we're not going to be able to make money around here. If you guys are, you know, assassinating the president, this is just going to wreck everything, so we're not doing it here. So figure out something else. But yeah, I put the picture in there, and he said, yeah, I was tasked to go find a spot, and I found a spot, and I thought it would work, but they said no. So that's what they send him out doing, looking for places and doing that kind of stuff. And so when he did go to Dallas, David Atlee Phillips and, David Atlee Phillips was the controller for both Lee Harvey Oswald and James Files. Okay. Back in those days, they both had to answer. James Files and Lee Harvey Oswald had to answer to David Atlee Phillips. Here's a picture that Lee Harvey Oswald took of James Files at that motel, in the Lamplighter Motel over there in Mesquite, Texas. And so, you know, you can tell how young he is there. They're both, you know, 20s. Well, actually, he was a little younger, but Lee Harvey Oswald was a couple years older. But they both had the same CIA controller. And
now, in the book, James, when James Sutton at the time went to mm-hmm. the motel in Mesquite, he checked in the motel, and mm-hmm. he waited for orders. He got orders. And it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm not right in this, that one day Lee Harvey Oswald showed up and was instructed to show James Sutton, James Ross, show him around, right? And that's
right.
What happened.
In Dallas, because okay. he was familiar with the area. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
They didn't talk about this assassination when they're riding around together, but they're both CIA operatives, and if they would say too much at the wrong time about the wrong thing, then they'd have to report on one another, and then that would ruin their intelligence career.
Okay.
So they just stuck to the script. He showed them around. He even took him out to his field where he was test firing some weapons. And even in the Warren Commission that said that some lady thought she saw a couple teenagers out in the field shooting. And so that could have been James Files and Lee Harvey Oswald, because that's what they were doing before the assassination. And the day of the assassination, he didn't see him, but all the other days before that, he had hung out and spent time with them, learning all sorts of areas and, you know, dead ends and where train crossings might be and whatnot. And
for about 3 days, is my understanding. Or the better part of a week, Lee Harvey Oswald drove Mr. Sutton, Mr. Files around, showed him different places. Mm-hmm. And at some point...
Yeah, Lee Harvey Oswald could drive. Okay. Everybody says he couldn't drive. He could drive.
He could, right. So at some point, James Sutton said, that's the place right there, the grassy knoll area. Is that true? I mean, is that how that happened? But didn't obviously.
Well,
go ahead.
They didn't go. Lee Harvey Oswald and James Files didn't go to Dealey Plaza and talk about buildings and railroad crossings there. They just drove through the area a few times, but they didn't, you know, stop and say, "Oh, this is where it's going to happen." Oh, by the way, I work at that book depository. They didn't talk about any of that kind of stuff.
Okay.
He was just a CIA operative helping him learn the area in Dallas, and that was about it. And you're not supposed to ask a bunch of questions. Otherwise, then you get reported on, and then there you go.
And Lee Harvey Oswald and James Sutton knew each other prior to this, at least by sight?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes. David Atlee Phillis had them in Clinton, Louisiana, doing some gun running thing to Papa Doc in Haiti back then. They were getting arms through different shipping companies and some big hangar company down there. They had a weapons depot down there, so that's where he had met him before.
Okay, all right.
They already knew each other. It's like when he knocked on the door, he said, "What the heck are you doing here?" "Oh, boss told me to come and show you around." So they knew each other from before that.
And
CIA stuff.
Exactly. And talk about compartmentalization. This is how it works. I mean, even today, it's the information when you're working with the CIA, it's my understanding that everything is compartmentalized. Need to know. If you don't need to know, you're not told, and shut up. Don't ask questions, basically. So, okay. And during that time, they went out, Oswald and Mr. Files at the time, James Sutton, it would be like you said, a field garbage kind of area where appliances were discarded and they were shooting weapons. What kind of weapons? And this gets into a very special weapon that was used by Mr. Sutton, according to his account in the book. What kind of weapon are we talking about here?
It was a Remington XP-100 fireball.
Okay.
That this isn't the exact gun, but it's similar to it, and it's a 2.21 for casing, and it did have the scope on it. But He also test fired Charles Nicoletti's rifles too, besides his handgun. He only fired one time.
Okay. Well, James only
make sure
fired.
It was aligned.
Right. Okay.
When they were test firing the weapons, they didn't make it, you know, big deal. But he wanted to test the scope on the rifle that Charles Nicoletti would be using, his backup rifle, and he wanted to test the fireball.
Okay, and the fireball is the weapon that James Sutton had, again, Mr. Files had, behind...
The CIA gave it to him as an assassination tool.
Okay.
And just recently, he coughed up the information that... because I was asking him about General Ed Lansdale, who came behind the fence before the assassination to make sure everything was ready to go, good to go. And... I said, well, what countries did you go use that? I'm not telling you. Well, did you go use it for assassination? Yes, that's exactly what I said. I used it for assassination a couple times before Kennedy. So, yeah, I knew it worked good. So, okay. So, yeah, General Lansdale, they nicknamed him the Kingmaker. He was grounds coordinator, that's what they call it, for the assassination. So that's why he came behind the fence before the motorcade arrived and made sure that he was on station in place and ready. And the reason they put him there is because Ed Lansdale knew, because of how Jimmy Sutton had made his mark, that he wasn't going to miss. So if anybody else in the back's missing, he knew that JFK wasn't going to leave Dealey Plaza alive with James Sutton behind the fence.
Okay.
So that's how that worked.
All right. So you brought us this far. Now, if you can give, and this is in the book, folks. I'm going to tell you, this is a great resource and a great read. I would urge everyone to grab yourself a copy of this book, Primary Target. I really like the way this is laid out. It's got a Q&A section in here. And I have to say, I was surprised by some of the answers. I was surprised by some of the questions, which were well done, but some of the answers indeed. So, okay. So, on the, if you can walk me through the preparations for November 22nd, 1963 are done. Walk me through that day and who was there and where were they? Like, James Sutton, we know, ended up behind the picket fence near the pergola. But who else was there to shoot President Kennedy? Was Lee Harvey Oswald one of them? Go ahead.
No, Lee Harvey Oswald said it brilliantly when he was in custody. I'm just a patsy. I didn't do it. I didn't shoot anybody. J.D. Tippit was not shot by Lee Harvey Oswald, and President John F. Kennedy was not shot by Lee Harvey Oswald, just to set that record straight. I know the history books are going to still say that he did both, but he didn't do either one.
And I found that extremely interesting, because the Tippit murder came into play in a way that I didn't see that coming. I didn't expect that. So, okay, but again, back to Dealey Plaza, who was there, who had weapons aside from Mr. Sutton, and who was going to shoot, and what were Mr. Sutton's orders? Go ahead.
The only other person that James Files can confirm that was there shooting at President Kennedy was Charles Nicoletti. And he said, I can't even prove that because I didn't see him shoot, but I said, well, you cleaned his weapon later at the hotel, so you know the gun was fired, so, you know, put two and two together. But that's it. If there were other shooters, and I believe there were, they compartmentalized it, and that's all he was supposed to know.
Yeah, and the other shooter...
Charles Nicoletti shooting from the Dow Tech building with Johnny Roselli there, picking up his brass, let in by Eugene Hale Breeding, who's with the California Mafia, which is connected to the Chicago Mafia outfit, that's what they call it. And that was in the Hunt offices that they were let in, and they were doing remodeling then just for the reason of it being unavailable for other purposes, but the shooters could go in there and shoot and get away with it and then leave. So so that was happening in the Dow Tech building. I think there was something going on in the Texas School Book Depository, but we can't prove who, where, and what. I mean, some people say Mac Wallace's fingerprint up the sixth floor, whatever, planted guns. Obviously, they planted guns to try and frame Oswald, but as far as people shooting from the storm drain, I don't think so. People shooting from the overpass, like Marshall Kaifano, I don't think so. He was a bomb. Jimmy says he's a bomber. He's not a shooter. So that guy, Marshall Kaifano, that was proven to be there, but he, and some people say, no, he was a shooter. No, he wasn't a shooter. And then this guy, Tosh Plumlee,
we've had Robert Tosh Plumlee on this show. I know Mr. Plumlee.
How's he doing?
Is he okay? I was just going to say, we've lost touch. We're talking probably five, 6 years ago. So I don't know, but he's been on the show
two or three times. So we'll see if he comes back.
Wow. This intersection of our interview, I mean, it's interesting, some of the very people that you mentioned in this book, because when I read this book, and by the way, folks, I did read this book cover to cover. It's excellent. Again, Primary Target. And on your screen right there, you can see where to get that for radio listeners, jfkmurderjamesfiles.weebly.com. Excuse me. Again, go to Hagman PI, click on the link. It's definitely well worth your money, time to read, and your money to invest, and get some great information. There it is on your screen.
One thing I want to say about the book, that website, they're for signed books, and they seem kind of expensive because they're books that we have to get shipped to us signed and then ship back out. They're signed books when they get it from our website. If they just want a book and they want to get it, you know, just real cut and dry, not make it a big deal about having the signature and thumbprint and all that, they can go to Author House, the publisher, authorhouse.com, just put in the Primary Target, or they can even go to the other A word, Amazon. And you know what I mean? There's online booksellers that'll just sell it to you, and there's an ebook available for $5.99. If our book's on our website saying, oh, I don't want to spend that much money, well, I get it. But you know, if you want the book to read it, you can get an ebook for $5.99. Trying to just, you know, beat you over the head with, you know, the signed books, but they're available still, barely. We're about ready to not do that anymore, but you know, we're still sending out signed books if anybody wants them.
And I have to say that that's quite the endeavor. People don't realize what it takes to ship out the books yourself and such. So I applaud your efforts on this. Okay. November 22nd, 1963, one question I had that I'm not sure, maybe it was addressed in the book, but if not, help me out here. The route to the trademark or the trademart was changed. Do we know why, and do we know by who changed that route?
So it would go right by the sniper's nest, quote unquote, the book depository, and the grassy knoll.
Do we know who changed that, though?
I think it was the mayor, Earl Cabell.
Okay.
Charles Cabell's brother, Earl, that was fired by the when the thing was happening at the CIA with Alan Dulles and Charles Cabell after the Bay of Pigs. His brother was the mayor of Dallas, so he had the ability to get something like that done.
Okay, and now we're connecting some dots here, folks. If you read John Stormer's book, None Dare Call It Treason, some of the backstory of this is contained in that book. This is fascinating. Okay, so James Sutton had the special weapon. Went to the grassy knoll. What time roughly did he get? Did he get there earlier in the morning? Would he set up?
He walked through the Dealey Plaza with Charles Nicoletti that morning, and Charles Nicoletti was just kind of using him as a sounding board to, you know, just to double check on where he thought the best places to shoot would be. And he says, "Well, up there in that Daltech building, about the second floor, I think that'd be the best from behind." And I've been asked to pick a spot, and I say behind that fence right there, because if everybody misses, I'll be able to get them right there.
That was his order, right? I mean, if I'm not mistaken, James Sutton was not to shoot unless it appeared that JFK...
Unless they were missing. And that's when he was counting the shots when they were going off. Miss, miss, miss. He wasn't going one, two, three. He was just counting them as misses because he was told they were going for a headshot. The headshot hadn't been made. So he had the scope, which he didn't really need, but he had it on there. And he was following the motorcade. And when he was fixing to lose his field of fire, and Jackie was about to come into the range, he took the shot, and everybody can see what happened.
Yeah.
And
man,
that's how that worked out. And then when he got back in the car after they reassembled after the assassination, he said the only thing that Charles Nicoletti said to him, "Don't you think you fired too soon?" And he said, "Well, I was going to lose my field of fire if I didn't shoot when I did." And then that's all he said. Johnny Roselli turned around, gave him some brass, said, "Here, you know, take it back to wherever." And he drove down the street a little ways, dropped him off at a gas station. They got in a different car, and then he drove back to his motel in Mesquite.
And in the meantime, what happened to, I mean, Lee Harvey, we know what happened to Lee Harvey Oswald. He was caught in a theater. What was that all mm-hmm. about?
David Atlee Phillips had met James Files at a restaurant in Dallas the night before the assassination. And then he said that he was going to meet Oswald there too, but I mean, they didn't overlap and get there at the same time, say hi to each other. But, David Atlee Phillips knew he was going to be a shooter the night before. And there's some other stuff that happened the night before, and I found out since I wrote this book. He's going to not be happy that I'm saying this.
James, hang in there. Take a nap, brother. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, don't listen. Gordon Ferry, who is former NSA and Secret Service, this guy, where is he? Gordon. Here's Gordon. He's up in North Carolina, but I don't think they got any problems. But anyway, he wrote this book. It's a real thin book. It's called Evil. And he talks about the meetings that happened before November 22nd, on the night before. A lot of people don't want to admit that they were at those parties. Okay? I'm just going to say that. And so...
By parties, you meant meetings. You referenced meetings, but parties.
Meetings. Like with people that were the planners of this assassination, like this guy right in the middle, you know,
Hoover.
He knew he was going to be able to cover it up. That director of the FBI, you know, transvestite, that guy. And there's General Lansdale there in that picture.
And Lansdale, remind the audience again who Lansdale was. He was a groundskeeper. He was present behind the fence to make sure that Mr. Sutton was in place at the time. But who was he again?
He was a CIA grounds coordinator.
CIA.
He worked basically the behest of his handler, Alan Dulles.
Got it.
So he was out running around the world doing stuff in the Philippines and wherever, Vietnam. For the CIA. And all right. So he was there for the assassination. But this is a really important additional information. I went through and corrected a bunch of stuff in here because it needs a little bit more work. But as far as when he's identifying his name, it's James Sutton or James Files.
Wow.
It was a big deal that they were there. And part of the reason, as an investigative person, you know that there's no statute of limitations for murder, right?
Correct.
And he thinks he's never going to get indicted for JFK because it wasn't a federal crime when the state of Texas basically had JFK eliminated. So he doesn't think that that's going to ever be any problem. But some of the other stuff that happened in Dallas and Fort Worth during that time period, he thinks he could still get in trouble for. So that's why he didn't want to keep talking about it. And he's like, "I can't tell you everything." I'm like, "Well, you need to, because I want to know what the truth is." So, we go through those kind of things. And
well, I'm amazed.
He got really upset at me. That I was pushing them for so much information.
Yes. But I think America, and I think everyone would agree with this, Americans deserve to know the truth. Americans deserve
to know. He says he doesn't think they do deserve it, and I do think they deserve it. Well, I'm sick of being lied to myself.
Me too. Yeah. Okay.
And I think we deserve the truth, and, you know, we're supposed to have a heart for the truth, and God's going to send us strong delusion if we don't love the truth. So I don't want to be deluded any more than I have been in my lifetime, and I want to know the truth. So his mindset is different than ours because he's had his whole life to have to do things and then not have to get in trouble for it. And that's a long time of a lot of stuff.
So, I mean, just between you and I.
Another situation was the one that was in doubt.
Okay. All right. But just between you and I, as if, right? But just like we're talking, let's say the kitchen table, you know, well, I'm going to leave. I just think the information that you have provided in this book, that James has provided in this book, is it answers a lot of questions that I had. Well, let me move on to, we talked about the weapon, but there was a special kind of bullet. And this, and I made a reference to my friend James Corsi, his book, along with a medical doctor and PhD, wrote the final analysis, where they examined the brain, the pictures of the brain and such, and there were traces of mercury in that they verified. But also, the Warren Commission made reference to that. Let's talk about the bullet that was used by James Sutton, James Files.
Okay, it was a mercury load, which I guess they drill off the tip of the cartridge or the tip of the missile, and then it's filled with mercury, and it helps it explode on impact so that you know that it's going to be a really big, you know, devastation rather than it just being a piercing type of a bullet. So his friend George Kalura, Marine guy that he had the same hobby of, you know, liking guns and gunsmithing and going out to the range and shooting off a bunch of rounds just to stay good at, you know, hitting your target. Anyway, his friend George Kalura, he nicknamed him Wolfman. He's the one that made the mercury loads for the trip to Dallas. He even asked him if he needed any help, because when he was getting the weapon and the mercury rounds from him before he left for Dallas, he's like, well, do you need any help? He goes, no, I don't think I'm going to need you on this one. So he offered to even go down there and help him if you know, he didn't even know he was going to go use it for the president. He just knew he was on a mission and he was going to see if he could help him. He said, no, that's fine. And then I guess he test fired one of them with Lee Harvey Oswald, and then all the rest of them he kept in the briefcase, and it was one shot. You know, when he used it, he says, if you need more than one shot, you know, you're in the wrong business, because you're supposed to be able to hit your target with one shot if you're a sniper, right? And so,
Eric the Tech and I stood, presumably, now I don't know this for a fact, but we stood in behind the fence in the we believe would be the approximate area that well, I can tell you this, the picture on the front cover of this book is where and folks, again, the book is Primary Target. It's well worth your money and your time to read. That's where Eric and I stood, and it was just an amazing view to the X on the pavement. And it's not that far. I mean, you know, I was in Butler. There,
88 feet, I think, or 88 yards. It's real close.
Yes,
he said he didn't even need the scope.
Exactly.
But, you know, he was using it.
And I have to say this, and then I'm going to ask you another question. But when we went to Dealey Plaza, that was a number of years ago. But recently with Butler, both Eric the Tech and myself and some other investigators said, boy, this feels a lot like Dealey Plaza. I'm just saying. Now, I've got another question for you coming right up. Before I do, I just want to take this brief break, folks. Go to sculptnation.com/Hagman. You know, most guys think right now that their testosterone is being drained by aging, bad genetics, or maybe even a lack of exercise. But what if I told you that wasn't the case? In fact, the real culprit is something.
Can you guess which one of these foods?
Yeah, sorry about that. You're likely eating every day is one of the culprits. And here's the shocking part. Something that you've always told has been told is healthy. This one food has been scientifically shown to devastate testosterone levels. And most men have no idea. It's not junk food, it's not sugar. It's something way more unexpected. And just eating it a few times a week is enough to really mess with your testosterone, wreck it, drain your energy, crush your motivation. But here's the good news. Cutting this one thing out of your diet could be really transform the way you feel. Our friends at V-Shred, that's V-Shred, have seen it firsthand with their clients. And the guys who stopped eating it are building muscle, burning fat, feeling more energized than they have in years. It's really incredible how quickly things can change once you know what to avoid. And V-Shred, the team behind cutting-edge fitness and nutrition strategies, has created a video that reveals exactly what testosterone-killing food is and why removing it from your diet could be the key to unlocking your body's potential. Now, if you want to know what this food is, go over to sculptnation.com/Hagman, two ends on Hagman. That's sculptnation.com/Hagman, two ends on Hagman. It'll be in the program description box below this video. And watch the video or just click the link below because it is hyperlinked to that video. V-Shred's experts break it all down, and this one simple change could make all the difference. Trust me, this is one thing you don't want to miss. Let me tell you, as we age, guys, you don't have to lose testosterone. Telling you, take it from me. And I get my levels checked all of the time, or not all the time, with each blood test, and I got me some testosterone. SculptNation.com/Hagman. All right, with me, my very special guest, the wife of James Sutton, James E. Files, and she is Pamela J. Ray, or Pamela Ray Files. That's James Sutton, James Files' wife, married after he served his prison sentence. And I've got to tell you a very interesting story behind their relationship, and it's really encouraging to me that the man who says, "Hey, I fired that final and fatal shot," can actually change and turn his heart over to God and ask for forgiveness. But we need to keep praying for that, folks. We need to keep praying for him, for both his physical recovery as well as his relationship and walk with God. I'm just saying that we all need that, but especially James Sutton. So I ask you, humbly ask you to please pray for his, again, walk with God and his physical recovery. You know, it's something that there's good in everyone. And I'm telling you right now, having spoken briefly with, Mr. Files, pray for him. Really, seriously, pray for him. And pray for Pamela as well. She's got a burden to bear as well. Pray for her, because for her wisdom, too, as to what to release and what not to release, when to release it, and, you know, all of that. So, okay. Now, my question has to do with, so you took us through James Sutton going to Mesquite, Texas, about a week before, setting up in a suburb of Dallas. Lee Harvey Oswald comes in, shows Mr. Sutton around. There were meetings that took place and so on. One thing we didn't touch on was the murder of Officer Tippett. I found the explanation in the book very interesting, and it made sense to me. Do you want to address that a little bit?
Sure.
Okay.
Officer J.D. Tippett knew this guy that James Files knew. His name's Gary Marlowe, and his nickname was the Raven. And he had known the Raven since childhood. They grew up in Melrose Park together, and, you know, buddies from a long time. Go fishing together as kids, that kind of old friend. And so J.D. Tippett and Gary Marlowe knew each other from the Florida training camp when the Bay of Pigs thing was going on, because he kind of wanted to get in on the action. He could see Jim Files or Sutton going and doing stuff and always having money and buying a car and doing this and that and the other thing. And he wanted to make some money too. So he ran it by David Phillips, I guess. And so David Phillips said, yeah, he can bring in people. We can have this cover thing as a fishing camp down there, and he can work with us, because he didn't really want to go out on the field and, you know, start shooting up people. He just wanted to be a logistics support. And so during the time of all that, I don't know why J.D. Tippett was down there, but they knew each other from Florida. So when Gary Marlowe was brought in, he was out looking for Oswald, and then he ran into J.D. Tippett over there at 10th and Patton in Dallas, and they recognize each other. And so that's why Officer Tippett didn't even draw his weapon. He wasn't threatened or feeling like his life was in danger, but because of what would happen if he was exposed, that he knew that he was in Dallas, he had to kill him. I'm like, I still don't understand how all these things work. But he killed Officer Tippett. And then by the time James Files went to the motel in Mesquite, knock, knock, knock on the door, and he's like, what now? And so he opens the door, and there's the Raven, Gary Marlowe, and he's like, I'd burn a cop. I need to get rid of this gun, you know? He's like, I got enough problems. I don't need your gun if you just killed a cop with it. So he's like, shoot him out of the area and, you know, see you back in Chicago.
I hate when they come
to the door, there's a gun they need to have disposed of. So, yeah,
Eric, that's the tech what does that to was me. All about. Eric the Tech all the time. Hey, I need to get rid of this. Hey, hit the road, Jack. I got enough problems. Now, that answers that question about Tippett, because that seemed like to be an outlier. But it was because Tippett was involved in some training under Phillips, Atlee Phillips, David Atlee Phillips, and Gary Marlowe, the Raven, and Tippett knew each other, and it was a chance meeting, right? Mm-hmm.
It was a chance meeting, and that's why, like I said, Tippett didn't draw his weapon thinking that he might be coming there to shoot him or something. He just thought he was going to say hi to his friend.
Yeah.
And then they send their friends to kill you, I guess.
And that was in the book. Mm-hmm. And it rings true. Look, the CIA, they send the friends, or not the CIA, but the, both the CIA, I guess, and the outfit.
For the same coin, both sides of the same coin, the CIA and the organized crime.
Man.
And now they're comfortably merged. I always kid them because in Chicago, it's really bad. I'm like, dude, that was, you guys did all the groundwork. You comfortably merged the bad forces all together with the politicians. Isn't that special? So, Illinois is a big mess, and I don't see it getting fixed anytime soon. But, that's what they made.
You know, that's exactly right. That's what they made. I'm going to get to the part two now where Jack Ruby was part of the planning, am I correct, of – well, I shouldn't say part of the planning, part of the process before.
Jack Ruby met with Johnny Roselli the morning of the assassination and gave Johnny Roselli the Secret Service ID pins that changed the color every day. And he gave him those pins for the people that were going to be on the Grassy Knoll area impersonating Secret Service, and also the map for the motorcade route that had a small slight change because it was supposed to just go down Main Street and it took the corner of Houston and then Elm Street. So those, the Secret Service pins and the change map were in the envelope that they went to the Old South Pancake House there in Fort Worth. We go there sometimes when we go down to Dallas. And there's pictures in there of the old, because they had to move it for construction reasons, whatever, down there in Fort Worth. But they kept the pictures of the original Old South Pancake House, and you can see the counter and where James Files would have been sitting, and then where Jack Ruby and Johnny Roselli had met. Johnny Roselli asked James Files or Jim Sutton to watch his back to go meet Jack Ruby because, you know, they all don't trust each other. And so, yeah, he went in, positioned himself, and then Jack Ruby came in, gave Johnny Roselli that envelope, manila envelope, and then he left, and then Johnny and James Sutton went back to, from Fort Worth, Old South Pancake House, over back to the Cabana Hotel over there in Dallas, and then they waited till it was time to get ready for the motorcade to arrive.
Okay. And one thing I wasn't
going to... But Jack Ruby was there at that restaurant to give him that those crucial things that they needed for the assassination.
So Jack Ruby had CIA, obviously, ties, connections. Very mm-hmm. interesting. Okay. One thing I wasn't going to bring up, there's a little tidbit in the book. I'll bring it up, but there's a thousand more great little gems in the book. This interested me. After James Sutton, Mr. Files, took the shot that struck President Kennedy in the head, he did something that he would not normally do with the brass. Obviously, he picked up the brass. As all the shooters did or would, they'd pick up the brass and stow it away, carry it away. But in this case, James Sutton did something a little bit, ballsy, if I can say.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
He says he only did it because he was being young and cocky. He took the shell casing out and bit it and then set it on the picket fence. I don't really think that that's the one that they found in the 1980s, but it might be. But they did a test on it, and they said that the indentation marks that were on that shell casing were from teeth. But his teeth were knocked out in, I think, 1969 in Vietnam. Firebase, Brandyville, all that, and then get the butt of the rifle, knock all his teeth out, Ted Shackley, dentures, and all that. So he's had his dentures since late 60s, but his dental records could have proved if they had any dental records of when he was a kid, but I don't think they did because he said his mom took him to Navy doctors all the time.
Right.
So even if they would have had that, it would have been really hard to prove that those were his teeth marks, but they were teeth marks that were on that one shell casing. And who would know to say something like that unless they did it, right? Yeah. All those years ago.
Exactly. I mean, wow. Yeah. Yeah, I just thought, again, folks, primary target, the book, a lot of gems, a lot of pieces of information, ladies and gentlemen, that you will find in Primary Target. I'm a believer in this book. I would urge everyone to get your copy. I suggest the hard copy with a thumbprint.
It's true history. If people are into true history, you know, they'll get probably more than they want in there, because that's all I put in there. True history.
I was surprised.
That's my knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, now, you had mentioned this, and then we can go wherever you want to go. But you had mentioned, too, that Hoover knew. What's your take on, you showed the book Evil. What about LBJ? What's your take on that? It was LBJ.
He was going to get in trouble. The Kennedys were making it so he was not only going to not be vice president, he was going to be on trial and go to jail if they had their way about it, with their Bobby Baker scandals and all that going on. LBJ, I guess he even had his own sister murdered by that guy, Malcolm Wallace. But he had his own hitman, Malcolm Wallace, and he was up to his wherever eyeballs in all sorts of political intrigue in Texas. To this day, they still don't like us down there in Texas, saying, you know, somebody besides Lee Harvey Oswald did it. Because, I hate to say this, but Dallas is a city that has a lot to lose if the truth comes out. I'm surprised they even still have the Texas book depository and the whole museum thing going. It just draws attention to what big liars they are. But I'm surprised they didn't demolish Dealey Plaza, get rid of the crime scene, but they like making money off of it, I guess. So, but they got a lot of explaining to do, because there's, you know, a lot of stuff that went on before the assassination that people enriched themselves in that area by the death of President John F. Kennedy. You know, we all know about Bell Helicopter and the Vietnam War, right? And all the stuff, all the things, chemical warfare. It turned into, you know, a big branch of the military-industrial complex down there, and they don't want everybody talking about that part of the assassination. Lee Harvey Oswald did it. Just get over it, and let's come on up, $16 to come see our museum, see all our BS books, and, you know, here's a souvenir Jackie. Bye. You know, it's just sad to see that's what they do when people go there and they honestly want the truth. When I go there and I set up, you know, here we are, whether they like it or not.
Now,
they don't like us down there.
No, I've been down there. Eric, like I said, Eric the Tech and I have both been down there, and we get the vibes. There's just a weird
thing. Did you go see that memorial that's like a block away from the JFK thing that looks like a big tomb, big cement tomb? Did you see that memorial that they have there? It's so disrespectful. It's not a memorial for JFK. It's a disrespectful thing, I think. And that doesn't look right either.
Okay, yes, I know what you're talking. In fact, I think I might have some photographs of that, but I don't have them available. Yes, exactly. Now, we've got about...
There's a lot of bad stuff still going on down there, and they don't want to talk about the truth about JFK.
No, no one does. And we're finding this out, too, folks, how this relates to today about Butler and about Florida. You think these people are out of business? No, the names might be changed, but the system's... the same. Go ahead.
No. The military-industrial complex has turned into, you know, the food industry killing. I mean, it's just beyond the military. You know, it's a lot of stuff that guy Robert Kennedy Jr. is talking about. I was listening to him this morning. I'm like, well, at least he's telling that much truth about what's really going on, about how our kids are getting poisoned with the food and the vaccines. And, oh, no, she said the B word. Uh-oh. So, yeah, it's just really bad. And then our freedom of speech is going to be taken away just because we want to say the truth about what's been going on since then, since 1963. I guess so. It's called misinformation or disinformation now, and they're going to really clamp down on that. Well, what about it just being the truth? No, we're going to decide what's truth. Exactly. We're in a scary position if they're supposed to be telling us that kind of stuff's the truth.
So, we've got about 14 minutes left of the show. So I want you to let her rip wherever you want to take this, because, again, folks, look, take my word for it. This is one of the best books you're going to read about the JFK assassination, Primary Target, written by this man, James Sutton and Pamela. Well, written by both James Sutton and Pamela Files. Get your copy today. In fact, the link to purchase this book, you can get it a signed copy, and I highly recommend that. Sorry to make you work harder. Or Author House, or the other A word on the internet, but
or the other A word. They don't need any promotion.
No. So.
Not with those huge buildings. I see those huge buildings. I'm like, what are they getting set up for that nobody can buy or sell without the mark? What's all that?
And see, this is why I'm so glad you're here. Again, wherever you want to take this, whatever you want to talk about the remaining time that we have together, what the heck is going on today? Because what's going on today was rooted back then, really took root. And... So go ahead, wherever you want to take this.
I'm going to take you back beyond 61 years on 1963. I want to take you all the way back to 500 years ago. The Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, that's what's still going on. And to put it in a little nutshell, the Jesuits were started back then to counter the Protestant Reformation. And right now we're seeing weaponized Jesuit-inspired weaponized illegal immigration, illegal wars. I mean, they control all these facets of media, society, education, and nobody's talking about them. Why? They're hidden in plain view. I mean, why can't we talk about those guys? There's a new documentary out, this Christian filmmaker named Christian J. Pinto, and it's called American Jesuits.
I know Chris.
I think people should get there and watch it.
I know Chris. I've had him on. Chris Pinto.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
After I finished my book in 2020, I was still feeling like I am missing so much of what's really going on. Please, God, help me. Help guide me to the truth. So I went to Before It's News, started listening to this one Watchman for the Body of Christ, Dr. Scott Johnson on Contending for Truth. Got a lot of information figured out there. And then part of one of his recommendations was watch the true history about the, you know, Riddles and Stone, Washington, D.C., whatnot, the true story about the Bible, the lamp in the dark. I don't know what you've already talked to him about, but I really appreciate all his true history documentaries, because not everybody's going to pick up a book and read it, especially when it's that thick. You know what I mean? People will watch these films and get a really fast understanding for how long what's been going on. Somebody else is writing a book, and I haven't seen it yet. I think he's in the process of writing it. It's called Jesuit New World Order, and it's the destiny of man through the lens of the COVID-19 pandemic or whatever. It's this subtitle like that. It totally helps you understand what's going on in the world right now without all the misdirection and misinformation that the Jesuits would like you to just not even know that they exist and that they're the hidden hand behind this. And like, what? That's the Catholic Church. Oh, you can't talk about them. Well, I just did. And I just said it. And there, this country back in 1852 was warned that Charles Chiniquy, the guy that was friends with President Abraham Lincoln that warned him the Jesuits were going to get him. In 1852, the bishops in America, in Buffalo, New York, had a plan to subvert and destroy this country. And I think they've been pretty successful, and nobody's even calling them on it. But if you've talked to Chris Pinto,
yes,
I'm really encouraged, because he gets the big picture. He gets the Jesuits' hidden hand and their weaponizing, you know, illegal immigration and the vaccines and all the bad stuff that's going on, and somebody to blame. And he gets it. And I just want people in the audience to understand that we're living in really perilous times. And the Bible even calls it perilous, dangerous, you know. And deception is all over the place. And we have to get back to understanding and loving and knowing God's word and comparing things to what's in the Bible. I know a lot of people don't want to do that much work, but it's really, it'd be worth it to do it, because everybody check out Israel right now and check out what God says about what's going to happen to Israel. And the time of Jacob's trouble, the 7-year tribulation, is what's about to happen. But what happens before the 7-year tribulation? As far as I can tell, the pre-tribulation rapture happens, and most people aren't talking about it in the Christian church. Oh, no, we got to talk about Donald Trump. We got to talk about Harris. We got to talk about that stuff. Well, the rapture is about to happen, so why can't we talk about that? Oh, no, we dismissed that back in the 80s. Well, no, let's not dismiss it, because as we get closer and closer, we're supposed to be looking up as we see these things happen, and knowing our redemption is almost at the door. That's what I want to talk to people about. Getting close to God, meaning it, getting in his word, understanding the word of God, and just really, what does that have to do with the JFK book? Well, the only reason I even know James Files is because of the Lord. I mean, that's how this whole thing even started, because on his Confession of Assassin video, he is asked, oh, do you believe in God? Bob Vernon, the interviewer, asked him, and he goes, I guess so. I found myself praying to him on several occasions. And I'm like, that guy needs help, man. He needs some serious help. And he's almost been tortured to death by the FBI, God only knows who, and everybody else. Why would you want me to encourage him in the Lord? I wrote to him. That's how we met. Because the Lord prompted me to help him understand who the Lord Jesus Christ is. That's it. And the rest is history. But because I had that love for the truth, this is where the truth has led me to back to God's word, and why it's so important right now that we understand the times that we live in. There are going to be people that are left behind. There are going to be people that get saved during the tribulation, but doesn't everybody want to be in the first batch? I mean, I do. I sure don't want to stick around for any of the not fun that's going to be happening in the next 7 years. And Israel is the clock. Jerusalem is the hour hand, and the Temple Mount is the second hand. Everybody just pay attention to what's going on over there. We're getting really, really close to the second coming. Not the second coming at the end of the tribulation, but the gathering together of him at the beginning of the tribulation. I just want to encourage all my Christian brothers and sisters to be ready for that, because we got the Rosh Hashanah coming up, blowing the trumpets coming up. So I just, you know, everybody be ready. That's what I want to tell everybody. Be ready for the Lord.
And folks, look, Pamela, we have a rather divisive the audience when it comes to the timing of the tribulation. Personally, it's going to happen when it happens, but people need, like you said, people need to be looking toward God, looking up, seeking their own redemption, you know, repent, be prepared. Because, man, you know, as you said, look what's going on with Israel. Who would have thought a couple of years ago you would see this great incursion now into Lebanon by Israel? Who would have thought the events over the last couple of years would have happened? But you're right. I mean, regardless of which end of the spectrum you fall on, you're correct. You know, we have to do this. And that's an amazing story, how you reached out to James Files and how you witnessed to him. And that's an amazing story. It really is. So
it really is. And I personally have never had Jesus come and see me. It seems like people in my life get to see Jesus, but I don't get to see him like that. But when I first became a Christian in 1982, I mean, I radically got saved. It's a long story if anybody ever wants to hear it. But, you know, it's my testimony. And I read in the Bible when I was a baby Christian that Thomas wouldn't believe in Jesus unless he could put his hands in the place where it was in the, you know, the nails. And Jesus said, you, Thomas, are blessed because you get to see me and you believe. And then there's going to be a lot of people after you that are going to be a lot more blessed because they don't see me, yet they still believe. I'm like, oh, good. I get to be blessed even if I don't get to see Jesus. James Files had Jesus visit him twice, not once, but twice in prison. Okay. And the message was, you're an unbeliever. You know, you need to get your life in order. You know, doing it your own way isn't going to make it. So basically, he came and personally visited him in prison. Like I said,
amazing.
That's a special thing.
And you are there to help him stay on the path and do just that. Because eternal salvation.
It's been 25 years. The first letter I wrote to him was February of 1999, 2024. That was 25 years ago.
Any regrets? Any regrets?
Don't get me started. The only thing I regret right now is that my family, my children, and my grandchildren, that's at a luau over there in Hawaii. I mean, I don't get to see them anymore. They're in Hawaii. I'm over here. My dad's in Oregon. You know, I'm in Illinois. It's just, the only regret would be that I just wish it somehow could have worked out where I could have seen my grandkids a lot more in the last several years since being over here. But it's okay.
I understand. Okay. Other than that. And that's,
I'm just kind of stuck over here on the mainland.
Well, and folks, that's why we need to pray, not just for James Files, but also for Pamela Ray Files as well, for both of these fine people. Please, look, prayer moves mountains. I've seen prayer work in my life and other people's lives, and I ask for your prayers for both James and Pamela. Pamela, I just want to say thank you so very much. I know this took a lot out of you, and I want to thank also my our mutual friend, Johanna Lowe, for helping establish this interview. Appreciate that. But
you know,
I just want to say thank you because I know this, and also please extend our thanks to Mr. Files for filling in some blanks that we would not have ordinarily had. Thank you, my dear.
Yeah. A lot of people find the part in the book with the question and answers. If they have still a bunch of questions in their mind, read the book and you will find probably the answer that you're looking for right there. Because we've had all the comments. I think one question was asked to me, I don't know, 10 or 12 times about Gary Marlowe. And I just kept putting it in there. Hopefully they'll get it now. It's in there a lot because people just keep asking the same questions over. I'm like, okay, let's do it again.
Understand.
So, yeah, it's been.
Understand. We're out of time. Pamela Ray Files, God bless you. Thank you. Folks, that'll
God bless you.